2012, February 6th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 22, The Family of the Sun. This is the first lecture in the new unit, Unit 4, Life in the Solar System. Some of you may have noticed this is Astronomy 141, but for the last 2 weeks it's looking an awful lot like Principles of Biology 101. And that, of course, is because what we're trying to do is set the stage for understanding how to look for life on other worlds. The first thing you've got to do is understand what life is like on Earth to inform what are we going to look for. You know, as the old statement goes, looking for life on other worlds is like looking for the smallest needle possible in the largest haystack you can imagine, except that you don't know what a needle is supposed to look like. Or maybe you do, but you've only got one example. So having set that basis, we are now ready to turn to the question of life on other worlds, and we're going to start that by starting this new unit today, Life in the Solar System, where we will be for the next 2 weeks. To start that, we're going to look at other worlds, and the obvious other worlds to start with are the other worlds of our solar system. Until about maybe 10, 15 years ago, these were the only worlds we really knew of around other stars. Now, the number of planets around other stars has simply exploded, and we are just but one of many solar systems that we know of in the nearby universe. So we want to start by using our solar system again, both as a place to explore this question of where life might emerge other than on the Earth in our solar system. What is it that makes the Earth unique about the planets of our solar system? But also to set the stage for a comparison with these other solar systems we have been discovering over the last decade and a half. Where should we be looking? There are 200 billion stars in the galaxy. We can't look at all of them, so how do we narrow the search? And what we're going to try to do through this unit is set both the question of, has life arisen elsewhere in our solar system, on the worlds we can explore, or places we will be exploring in the next few years? And then what lessons can we take from the nature of the planets in our solar system to tell us where we should be looking around other stars? So today we're going to be doing a whirlwind tour of the solar system. And this lecture, unlike a lot of others, is a little bit longer in terms of the amount of material, but you'll notice it's mostly graphical. Those of you who printed out the slides will know that this is one of the first times I've given you full color printout. And the reason for that is I tried converting to black and white and looked horrible. This is actually the best graphics I can find. There will only be a few of those in this section. I know that kind of stresses out some of your printers. Just kind of bear with it. I apologize for the ink. It won't be that common. So today what we're going to do is take a whirlwind tour of our solar system. We're going to look at the sun, the terrestrial planets, the Jovian planets, the dwarf planets, the giant moons, the trans-Neptunian objects, the asteroids, comets, and meteors, the whole denizens of our entire group that we call the solar system. And we're going to see a couple of interesting facts. One of them is that all the planets lie in nearly the same plane, and they all orbit in the same general direction. And that's true for the 8 planets. There used to be 9, now there's 8. We'll talk a little bit about that as we get moving along. This is just a try to impress you. We've done a whole bunch of stuff slide. We are currently in the golden age of solar system exploration. While it seems like NASA's on the decline because of the slow but sure ramp down of the manned space program and the fact the shuttles no longer fly, in fact, a lot of the efforts at NASA have not been the manned space program, but our robotic space program, which has been going on since the 1960s. And it's a time of just simply phenomenal achievement. We have learned more since the robotic exploration program began in the 1960s than we have learned in all the rest of human history about the solar system. So far, we have landed men on the moon. We've actually returned a few hundred kilograms of moon rocks and actually walked on the surface of another world. We have put robotic landers that have returned data and images on the moon, Venus, Mars, Titan, the giant moon of Saturn, and recently an asteroid, Itokawa. At least it made a little tiny touch on the surface and actually returned a very small sample. It wasn't 100% successful, but it did a pretty good job. We've returned rocks from the moon. We're currently in the process of planning stages of missions that will return rocks from Mars and possibly from asteroids. We've actually dropped probes into the atmospheres of Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and, of course, the giant moon Titan, a lander on its way down. We have flown spacecraft by all of the 8 major planets of the solar system and gotten very close-up images of every single one of them now. We have, in fact, an orbiter around 2 of those planets as we speak, the Messenger orbiter around Mercury and the Cassini orbiter around Saturn, and more are coming in the planning stages. We've had extensive observations of the planet Mars. In fact, we are in a period of tremendous Mars exploration. There are two rovers on Mars, one of which just shut itself down. It doesn't seem to be reviving. The other one is still going way past its expiration date. It's the toughest little rover in the solar system right now. We've mapped the surfaces of at least two worlds, Venus and Titan, with radar. And actually, we can add on to that, they've started using the radar mapper on Cassini on some of the moons. I did a quick sweep over the moon Enceladus. It's going to figure in a lecture later on in this series. We've set spacecraft into orbit around asteroids. The Dawn spacecraft is currently in orbit around the large asteroid Vesta. When it finishes its mission a little bit later this year, it will actually then fire up its ion engines and begin its way to encounter the largest of the asteroids, or one of the dwarf planets, Ceres. We have flown past a number of asteroids and comets, and we have a spacecraft currently on its way out to the outer edges of the solar system to the former planet, now dwarf planet, Pluto, and into the Kuiper Belt, which will have its encounter in a number of years. It's 2016, I think, is when Dawn makes it to Pluto. These are just some quick pictures of just even a small subset now of the various missions. The Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 spacecraft are the ones that are responsible for most of the images of the outer solar system that we have, especially Uranus and Neptune. Both of these spacecraft are still operational. They are nearing the edge of our solar system and about to cross into interstellar space. We'll say a bit more about that a little later when we talk about life on other stars. Apollo 11 through 17 landed two astronauts per mission, with the exception of Apollo 13, which had an explosion on board and had to return home, just barely made it. The Venus Magellan mission did a full radar map of this cloud-enshrouded planet and gave us our first view of its surface. The Cassini and Huygens spacecraft, Cassini is still in orbit around Saturn, actually beginning to exceed its nominal mission lifetime, giving us an unprecedented view of Saturn and its system of moons, which has got some big surprises, as we'll see in later next week. MESSENGER in the last year or so has just gone into orbit around the planet Mercury, giving us our first full look at the surface of Mercury. And finally, the Mars Exploration Rover. This is the current one, Opportunity, which is still in operation. And of course, in the last few months, a new Mars mission has just been launched with a much bigger rover, this one about the size of a Mini Cooper, which is basically a full geological and biological laboratory on its way to the red planet. So what is the family of the Sun? Well, the Sun, of course, is a middle-sized star surrounded by a retinue of eight planets, a number of dwarf planets, and a very, very large number of small solar system bodies. These naturally divide themselves into certain groups of planets by their types. The terrestrial planets are the inner rocky planets. They're the inner four: Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. The Jovian planets are the Jupiter-like planets that live in the middle to outer solar system. We actually now recognize them to be actually two classes of planets rather than one. We used to call them all the gas giants, or the Jovians. But recently we recognized that, in fact, they divide into two distinctive classes: the gas giants, which are Jupiter and Saturn, and the ice giants, Uranus and Neptune. And we'll say what that means here in just a second. Finally, we used to have nine planets. Pluto was the smallest of the outer planets and really an oddball. It just really didn't fit with the others. And in 2006, the International Astronomical Union redefined the definition of a planet to redefine Pluto and, of course, Eris, which is the body that got this whole thing started. It's an object reputedly larger than Pluto, although that's still somewhat controversial. Ceres, the largest of the asteroids, and a couple of other objects, Haumea and Makemake, make up the five so-called dwarf planets. These are rocky and icy bodies which live mostly in the outer solar system, with the exception of the largest asteroid, Ceres. And finally, there's just a whole lot of junk left over in the solar system. We have the icy objects, which are the Kuiper Belt objects. They live in the space beyond the planet Neptune. And, of course, the comets that occasionally plunge into the inner solar system. And the rocky bodies, the asteroids and the meteorites that we see in the inner solar system. So these are the basic denizens of the Sun. These are the objects of the solar system that we're going to be interested in. This is a fairly technical plot. We're going to see this a couple of times in various guises. But this particular one is a map of the solar system in which I've divided the objects up by, on the horizontal axis, I've given the distance of the object from the Sun in terms of the semi-major axis of its orbit. Because some of these objects are in elliptical orbits, I need a way to characterize the size of that orbit. So what I take is the half width of the longest axis of this long thin ellipse called the semi-major axis, and that's measured in astronomical units. If it's a circular orbit, the semi-major axis is the same as the radius. On the vertical axis, plotted in a powers of 10 plot in both of these axes, here is the mass of the object expressed in units of the mass of the Earth. So let's pay attention to the top of the diagram. Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars are these red spots here. Not surprisingly, the Earth has one Earth mass, and it is one astronomical unit from the Sun. These are the inner terrestrial planets. Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune are the giant gas giants and ice giants of the outer solar system. The first thing you see is that Jupiter and Saturn are very much larger than Uranus and Neptune, which are larger than all the terrestrial bodies. In orange, I've plotted the giant moons of the solar system. Our moon, which is sitting out at 1 AU, the four Galilean moons of Jupiter, Titan, the giant moon of Saturn, and Triton, unfortunately named Triton, the giant moon of the planet Neptune. Uranus has no giant moons. Purple, I've plotted the five dwarf planets, Ceres, what used to be the largest of the asteroids, now is the rocky innermost of the dwarf planets, Pluto and Eris, and according to this plot, it's still having Eris slightly larger than Pluto, although that's both those numbers are kind of bouncing around because this is really hard to measure. And then Haumea and Makemake, in fact, are almost indistinguishable in their basic properties, so they actually land on top of each other in this plot. And then the green plots are the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, and the sort of pale blue objects are the Kuiper belt objects that live beyond the orbit of Neptune. You'll notice how they all pile up, and there's definitely these lines here. These are not accidents. These actually form dynamical families in which their orbits are being shaped, in the case of the asteroids, by the gravity of the giant planet Jupiter, and in the case of the Kuiper belt objects, by gravitational interactions with the large ice giant Neptune. The fact that we see this is actually a signpost to the age of the solar system and the fact that the solar system actually has a history, a dynamical history. You don't just simply make a planetary system, put all the planets in place, and kind of give them a push. And they don't run like an eternal clock. They are a dynamically evolving system. What's happened over the course of the solar system's history is that Jupiter has moved in, and Neptune has slowly moved out. Most of that move in and move out occurred during that period, during the epoch of heavy bombardment, more than 3.8 billion years ago, when the construction debris, if you will, from the assembly of the solar system was being dynamically cleared out, primarily by the action of Jupiter clearing out the inner solar system and Neptune clearing out the outer solar system. Some of the material was tossed entirely out of the solar system or tossed inward, literally into the sun, and the others were gathered up into these two dynamical groups, the asteroids and the Kuiper belt objects. If the system was set up at the beginning and always was as it is now, you would not see these dynamical groupings. This is evidence of the dynamical evolution of the solar system. The outer solar system, well, it's kind of empty, and it's empty not because we don't know of anything, we don't have anything out there, but because objects out here are so faint and so tiny, they're almost impossible to see. It's very, very challenging to observe these couple of objects. We know that the existence of a very large cloud of material called the Oort cloud, named after Dutch astronomer Jan Oort, who recognized that the comets have to be coming from somewhere, and dynamically they appear to be coming from a region as far out as 10,000 to 100,000 astronomical units away from the Sun. Occasionally a passing star tickles them gravitationally, and they literally plunge into the intersolar system. This outer dashed line is the so-called tidal radius. It's the point at which the tidal fields, the gravitational fields from nearby stars and from the galaxy itself, takes any object out here and in a very short time would strip it away from the Sun. So it represents the place where, if you will, within this region is where you're dominated. As you're close to the Sun, you're more and more dominated by the gravity of the Sun, but as you move outwards, the Sun's grip eventually gets loose, and eventually you reach the point where the gravitational influence on a body out here is more dominated by the rest of the Milky Way galaxy than by the Sun. And so the Sun literally loses its grip. So there really is an edge to our solar system defined in terms of dynamics. There's another edge to our solar system, which we believe is somewhere out, way out in here, around 100 to 1,000 AUs, which is where the interplanetary medium and the interstellar medium begin to merge from one into the other. The current positions of the Voyager spacecraft are way out in this zone here. So we're just starting to get out of the backyard and into the interplanetary space. That was kind of a long time on this diagram, but it gives you an idea of what our solar system looks like. It's a pretty complicated place. This is a cartoon of the solar system as of October of 2009, when the last most recent group of these so-called dwarf planets were assigned, Haumea and Makemake, were added to the original three from 2006, Ceres, Pluto, and Eris. And we see what we've laid out here is the distances of these objects are only laid out in their order from the Sun, not in their actual proportions. And what's shown here are the relative sizes of the planets relative to the size of the Sun in terms of its physical radius. And what we see is there's really a very strong division among the types of planets. The interterrestrial planets are all pretty small. The total mass of the interterrestrial planets adds up to barely 2 times the mass of the Earth. Outside of that, we get the gas giants. Jupiter itself alone is 318 times the mass of the Earth. Saturn is another 90-odd. And then finally, we get the ice giants, which are out at sort of 15, in round numbers, the mass of the Earth. So there's a very clear distinction both in their sizes as well as in their compositions. We'll see in just a moment. The dwarf planets really are very distinct. They're very much smaller than either the terrestrials or the ice giants. They're in also different kinds of orbits. They live in different places. So they really are distinctive objects. Calling Pluto a dwarf planet instead of a planet is not a matter of semantics. They really are different objects than these other two groups, the other three groups of planets, the terrestrial planets, the gas giants, and the ice giants. Now, the orbits of the solar system, let's bring up the picture here, also show some terrific differences. Now I've laid out the orbits in their proportions of radius, and I've color-coded them up. So the inner terrestrial planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, live within 2 astronomical units. The gas giants start with Jupiter a little over 5 astronomical units, going all the way out to 30 astronomical units for the orbit of Neptune, actually 35 astronomical units. So the gas giants live in a very vastly empty space in the outer part of the solar system. The asteroids live in the space between Mars and Jupiter as part of that sort of gravitationally focused place from the gravity of Jupiter. Now, this is looking at the solar system from above. If we were to look at the solar system from a side, what we would see is that all the planets of the solar system lie very, very close to the same plane. They're not orbiting every which way. They're all orbiting within a few degrees of this one central plane. The central plane is actually defined dynamically by the orbit of Jupiter. Jupiter is the 800-pound gorilla of the solar system. The Sun's the dominant source of gravity, but Jupiter has all the angular, all the orbital energy of the system. And its gravity pretty much controls where everything else is to a first approximation after the Sun, which sets where they are. Jupiter is what pushes them around. It's the enforcer of the Sun, if you will. Furthermore, all the planets orbit in the same general direction. If I pick arbitrarily up as looking down on the Earth's orbit, such that if I use my right hand, place my thumb up, and curl my fingers along the orbital plane, I call that up. And I look down upon the plane, all the planets are orbiting in that direction. All 8 planets share that same kind of right-hand curl sense of motion around the Sun. That's, again, no accident. What that is a, if you will, a dynamical memory of the original swirling gas of disk, swirling disk of gas out of which the Sun was built. The Sun rotates in this general direction. All the planets share that general sense of rotation. And they even rotate, with a couple of interesting exceptions, which we won't go into in this class, in that same sense as well. So not only are they orbiting the same way, but they're turning in the same way. That's a dynamical memory of their formation. All of the planets collapsed out of this cloud of gas and debris that surrounded and built the original Sun, and they retain that as a kind of a dynamical memory. We're going to see some objects that do not move this way, and that tells you those are objects that, since their formation, have been dynamically stirred up. By what? Either the orbit of Jupiter, if you're in the inner solar system, or the gravity of Neptune, if you're in the outer solar system. A Let's look at the denizens of the solar system. First of all, at the very center of the solar system and containing pretty much all the mass of the solar system is the Sun. The Sun is a middle-age, relatively average-sized star. We say it's a sun-sized star just because we need some way to measure it. It's mostly hydrogen and helium. In fact, it's 99-point-something% hydrogen and helium. All the other metals, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, all the good stuff we need to make life of, is just traces inside the Sun. This is representing the raw gas and junk out of which the solar system was formed. It was mostly hydrogen and helium. We know the age of the Sun is about 4.6 billion years. We get that both from the ages of the oldest meteorites, the oldest construction debris left over from the solar system, and we get it also from models of how a Sun-like star should behave and what its age should be. And we can actually set pretty good limits on the age of the Sun because we actually understand how stars develop through the course of their existence. The Sun shines because it's hot. It's got a surface temperature of about 5,800 degrees Kelvin. This means it's going to emit radiation at mostly visible, ultraviolet, and infrared light. It's a kind of a yellowish-white star. If you were to look at it highly filtered with a gray filter, you would see it basically looking white with a yellowish tinge. Not that I recommend you do that, but if you look around at reflected sunlight, that's why we always, you know, draw the Sun with your bright yellow crayon. That's kind of that sense the Sun is yellow. That's really a reflection of the fact it's got a temperature of 5,800 degrees. In a couple of weeks, when we start talking about life around other stars, this is going to come into play because different stars have different temperatures, and that's going to change what their spectrum is going to look like on their host planets. Now, the fact that it's hot and it's 4.6 billion years is a problem. How does it stay hot? And the answer is it stays hot because it's fusing hydrogen into helium deep inside of its core. Basically, the Sun is taking some of its hydrogen and every second converting about 600 million tons of it into helium, and giving up the excess mass turns into pure energy, which goes into powering, going into heating up this massive ball of gas. The Sun is basically a mass of incandescent gas, if you want to remember it in any other way. If we look at the amount of hydrogen that's available for fusion, it's like looking at how capacious a gas tank is on a car. You only get one filling on a star, just like if you had a gas tank. Imagine a gas tank that came from the factory already sealed with a full tank of gas. By knowing your mileage, you would know how long you could drive it at a certain speed before you just ran out of gas. The same is true of a star. You know how fast it's eating up its energy because you can see how much it's shining. You know how much mass of fuel is available to shine. You do the math, how fast it's burning it up divided by how much you got. That gives you the rate. You turn the rate upside down, and that gives you a number of 10 billion years. So the Sun has enough hydrogen fuel in its core to burn, to shine, for 10 billion years. When it runs out of hydrogen, it will switch over to helium fuel. We'll see a little bit in a couple weeks how that does that. But that only ekes out about a gigayear. That's like having an auxiliary gas tank in your car, which instead of burning gas, burns yak butter. Okay? You can get enough energy from yak butter to keep your car moving along. Think of it as biofuel. But it isn't very efficient. And so you burn it up in a tenth the time. When you run out of helium, you're out of helium. That's too bad, Mr. Sun. You've got to then go through a series of changes, which will actually leave it as a white dwarf. But that's, again, a different story for a different day. Right now, we have a literally middle-aged star. It is about exactly, not quite, a little bit less than halfway through its hydrogen-burning lifetime. That has some implications we're going to see later next week, because the Sun's light is the power of life, right? Photosynthesis is responsible for energy for a lot of life. It also provides the heat that keeps the Earth warm enough to have liquid water to help out all the other life. But the Sun does not always shine at the same brightness. One of your homework problems last week noted that the Sun was fainter in the past. In the future, it's going to be brighter, a lot brighter. How is that going to affect the habitability of the Earth? And we'll see that next week. So today is really just a big grand tour through the solar system to set the stage for some questions that we're going to be answering through the subsequent lectures. Let's look at the planets. We're going to look at each of these in detail in subsequent lectures. The terrestrial planets are the ones we kind of care about because, well, one of them is our home, the Earth. These are the rocky planets found in the inner solar system. They range between 0.4 astronomical units from the Sun, in the case of Mercury, out to just about 1.5 astronomical units from Mars. And, of course, the Earth hangs out at about 1 astronomical unit, and Venus is out around 0.8. They all have rocky, solid surfaces, made mostly of silicates and iron. A solid surface means you have a place to stand. Density ranges from about 3.9 to 5.5 grams per cc. For reference, the density is basically the weight per volume. Water, pure water, at regular pressure and temperature, is 1 gram per cc. So a rock is about typically 3 grams per cc. You put a rock in water, what does it do? It sinks. Iron, pure iron can run up about 5 or 6 grams per cc. Steel's more like 10. You put a hunk of iron in the water, what does it do? It sinks. So these are going to have a higher density than water. You have to have a lower density than water to float. So these are going to be much denser than water, and their density tells us something about their composition. It tells us they're mostly rocks, silicates, and iron. And we already know from the Earth, and in fact know from studies close up, of all four of these planets, they're differentiated. The iron and nickel has sunk to the core. The silicates and oxygen have floated up to the top, forming a crust and a mantle and a central iron metal core, just like all the other, just like we've seen in the Earth. There are differences, however, that will become important when we talk about the terrestrial planets in detail tomorrow. The other thing is to look at their sizes. Mars is only about a tenth the mass of the Earth. Mercury is just under 6%, 5.5% the mass of the Earth. But Venus and Earth are pretty close to being twins. These are shown in their right proportions. Okay? Venus is a little bit smaller in radius, a little bit lighter. It's 82% the mass of the Earth. It could be the Earth's twin sister. But it's a very, very different place. It's a hot, inhospitable world. There's no liquid water. In fact, there's no water of any kind on Venus. And yet the Earth is a warm, wet world which harbors life. Mars is a lot tinier, a tenth the mass of the Earth. But it's a cold, dry desert world. Why are they different? We're going to be spending a lot of time answering that question and trying to understand, why is it that the Earth is the warm abode of life, Venus is not, and Mars today, apparently not an abode of life. The Jovian planets, the four outer gas planets of the outer solar system, live a long ways out. They're between 5 and 30 astronomical units from the Sun. They're composed mostly of gases, mostly hydrogen and helium, in fact. Jupiter and Saturn have a composition that's closer to the composition of the Sun than the Earth, which is mostly silicates and iron. Uranus and Neptune differ because while they have hydrogen and helium, they have an awful lot of ices and rock. That makes their density higher and their composition a little different. They reflect differences in the material they formed out of. All of these turn out to be very low density, between 0.7 to 1.6 grams per cc. Saturn has 0.7 grams per cc. Material with 0.7 grams per cc could float. So it's a commonplace of every school child's astronomy book. If you could find a big enough bathtub, Saturn would float in it. Well, not really, because floating is actually density, buoyancy against gravity, but we'll ignore that. Saturn's really low density. It's telling us it's mostly gas. Jupiter is mostly gas with a little bit of rock inside. These are going to be denser. These move up to the 1.6 grams per cc, which is telling you it's gas with an admixture of ice and rock. A little addition of the more dense stuff averages out to a much smaller amount. The other thing to notice about these planets is their immense mass. Jupiter is 318 times the mass of the Earth. Saturn is 95 times the mass of the Earth. Uranus and Neptune are 15 and 17 times the mass of the Earth, respectively. They could contain the entire inner solar system within them and barely change their mass. The total sum total of all the asteroids, all the moons of the inner solar system, all the planets of the inner solar system doesn't even add up to 2 times the mass of the Earth. Just barely 2 times the mass of the Earth. That's squat compared to the outer solar system. This is most of the mass of the solar system outside the Sun. And Jupiter is the biggest one of all. There's some differences, however. As I mentioned before, Jupiter and Saturn, or we're going to see, are called the gas giants. They have extremely thick hydrogen helium atmospheres over tiny rock and ice cores. To put them in scale, this is the Earth shown to the proper scale with Jupiter and Saturn shown in their appropriate scales. The Earth is really tiny. There are storms on the surface of Jupiter that are bigger than our planet. Uranus and Neptune are examples of what are called ice giants. They're a little bit smaller. Here's the Earth in proper proportions relative to Uranus and Neptune. They contain mostly ices, but they have thick hydrogen-helium atmospheres on the outside. Again, like Jupiter and Saturn, they have no solid surfaces. There's nowhere for anything to stand. The atmospheres get very heavy and very dense the further you go in. The pressure gets so high, nothing we think of can survive normally inside these things. On Wednesday, we're going to take a lot closer look at the Jovian planets, at the gas giants and the ice giants in some detail. But today, I just want to quickly introduce you to them so you'll know what they are. We talk about them on Wednesday. The smaller bodies of the solar system come in a series of groups. The first of these are the so-called dwarf planets. These orbit the sun, so they deserve the name planet, but they're much, much smaller than any of the other bodies in the solar system. And to put that in perspective, all of these pictures here, Earth and Moon are obviously real photographs. Ceres is an image taken with the Hubble Space Telescope, and these are artists' conceptions because we haven't gotten close enough to get really good pictures of these yet. We will, just give us time. But these are all drawn in their proper proportions to each other. The first thing that jumps out at you is that when Pluto was first discovered, people mistook how big it was. They thought it was actually the size of the Earth, literally the size of the Earth. But as better and better observations were made, Pluto's a long ways out. It's really hard to observe. It kept getting smaller and smaller. And part of the reason was it's a lot icier body than people had expected. Pluto is in fact smaller than our moon. Same is true of Eris, which is the other bright Pluto-like object, and large Pluto-like object of the outer solar system. Ceres is the largest of the asteroids, and it's quite a bit smaller. Makemake and Haumea. Haumea really does have that oval football shape to it. It has to do with its collision, how it was formed some a long time ago. But all of these dwarf planets are smaller than our moon. So that's one of the reasons why people have sort of said, you know, these really don't fit. They're just a whole lot smaller. The other reason why they don't fit is because their orbits don't follow the same pattern as the orbits of the other planets. Remember, all the major eight planets all orbited in the plane of the solar system. But Ceres, Pluto, Haumea, and Eris, I didn't plot Makemake on here because it was getting kind of messy, all have these wildly tilted orbits. That dashed line there, all the other planets are within a few degrees of that line. Ceres is way up out of the plane. Pluto has this huge plunging elliptical orbit, tilted by more than 18 degrees out of the plane. Eris has this really big ellipse, and Haumea, which are tilted all which way. These are very different bodies dynamically. They have a very different dynamical history than the other planets. They stand out for that reason. That's why we've got a separate classification. If we look down on the solar system, you can see the ellipticity of Pluto and Eris compared to the nearly perfectly circular orbits of things like Uranus and Neptune. They really do stand out differently. And so it really, for a while, you would call Pluto the ninth planet because it was really the biggest thing out there that we knew of. But once we discovered Eris in 2005, 2006, that view was no longer sustainable. It was pretty clear there could be as many as 40 objects within our solar system that fall in this class, most of them in the outer solar system. What are we going to have? 48 planets? We don't really want that. It's really clear that these things are different. They were kind of crudding things up. So we broke them out into their separate dwarf planet category. We're not going to say a whole lot more about the dwarf planets in this class because they're really not that interesting to us from the perspective of life. They really are out in the cold, frozen reaches of the solar system. They're the largest pieces left over from the formation of the solar system, but they're not going to be interesting to us for life. So we're going to leave them aside, but I want to just mention them for the completeness of our tour today. One other place, however, which we are going to be interested in are the giant moons. Now, they're moons because everything orbits the sun, but these have an orbit center around their host planet. There are seven recognized giant moons in the solar system. They're large, spherical, solid objects. Our moon is actually third from last. We have the fourth largest moon in the solar system. The largest is Ganymede, followed by Titan, the giant moon of Saturn, which also happens to be the only moon with a substantial atmosphere. It's not an orange fuzzball. You're seeing the cloud tops of what are actually nitrogen methane clouds on Titan. We're going to spend some time with Titan next week. It's actually a really interesting place. Callisto is another one of the giant moons of Jupiter. Io, the volcanic moon of Jupiter, the moon. Europa, the ice moon of Jupiter. Very, very interesting because beneath these ices, maybe a large liquid ocean. And liquid water is really important as a possible place for life. And finally, Triton, the frozen ice ball around the planet Neptune. Those are the seven main moons. There's going to be some others that are going to interest us. In particular, one real surprise, Enceladus, which is one of the frozen ice moons of Saturn, turns out to also show evidence of possible liquid water below its icy surface. We're going to meet that next week. We talk about the two most interesting children of Saturn, Titan and Enceladus. Well, as we move out of the solar system, this is the outer circle here with the bright blue ball is the orbit of Neptune at 30 astronomical units, we find that once again we get this pile up of objects called the, rather unimaginatively, the trans-Neptunian objects. The asteroids were named in the 19th century, in the early 19th century, when they were named because they looked kind of star-like through the early telescopes. And so they have this nice sort of fanciful name, asteroid. The Kuiper Belt objects, or actually these trans-Neptunian objects, some of which fell in a place referred to as the Kuiper Belt, were predicted to exist and then discovered, but named in the late 20th century, literally the 1990s, when maybe we're just less romantic and more interested in giving accurate names to things. It pretty much says trans-Neptunian means they're icy bodies that orbit beyond Neptune. So at least it's a descriptive name. They tend to be fairly low density. Their densities are between 1.2 and 2 grams per cc, kind of like dirty rocky ices. They include among their class the icy dwarf planets, the four of them, Pluto, Eris, Haumea, and Makemake. They're a dynamical family of objects between 30 and 50 astronomical units out called the Kuiper Belt, and even some of the moons of some of the dwarf planets out there. For example, Charon, the large moon of Pluto, is one of these outer icy trans-Neptunian objects. And Triton, the giant moon of Neptune, may in fact be a captured trans-Neptunian object from early in the solar system. And then we get a whole bunch of really distant outliers, things that we're just sort of finding not so much by accident, but by really, really hard effort to find the most distant large objects in the solar system. It's thought there are many hundreds of Pluto-sized objects, possibly in the dark outer reaches of the outer solar system, but they're so far from the sun and so faint, they're going to be really, really hard to find. And we found a handful of these. Just a handful. Eris and Pluto are the two largest, along with Makemake and Haumea. They make up the four dwarf icy planets of the outer solar system. But then there are other objects like having names like Sedna, Orcus, Quaar, and Varuna in the outer solar system. Now you might ask, what's with these names? Well, think about the names of the eight planets. Mercury, Venus, Earth, Erda, it's German, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Those are gods of Greek mythology. The Greek pantheon was pretty big, but it wasn't that big. And pretty soon we ran out of Greek gods and goddesses to name things. Pluto was the god of the underworld. Eris was the goddess of discord. She was the one that threw the apple into Olympus, the start of the whole Trojan War thing. And then we kind of gave up. And so Makemake and Haumea are Polynesian, actually they're Polynesian origins goddesses, I believe. Sedna is, I want to say Inuit, but in fact it's one of the northern Pacific Northwest peoples. Same with Orcus. Quaar is the native peoples outside of Los Angeles. The discoverer worked at Caltech in Pasadena, so he named it for the original inhabitants of the Los Angeles basin. Varuna, you will recognize for those of you who know something about Hindu mythology. So in fact, we're starting to name these for creation gods and goddesses from all the different cultures of the earth, which means we're going to get into some really long spellings and some really horrifically mispronounceable names. And I don't expect you to memorize any of them. You know about Pluto and Eris and probably Makemake and Haumea because they've really been singled out as the dwarf planets. But that's four vowels in a row. I don't even know where to start. I think it's Quaar is how you pronounce it. But I heard someone actually who studied the languages of the people in the original Los Angeles basin that there's still a handful of survivals, at least in the 19th century. And he said, yeah, I can't pronounce it either. Anyway. That's the outer solar system. We want to go back into sort of the leftover bits. The inner solar system are mostly rocky bits, although I will qualify that by saying that some discoveries have been made in recent years that have found that actually a lot of the asteroids are not just rock. There's actually a lot of ice buried out under the rock in the asteroid belt, especially in the outer parts of the asteroid belt. We're far enough out from the sun that ices, volatiles as they're called, of things like carbon dioxide ice, water ices, can actually form fairly copiously. And one of the real interests, for example, in the Dawn mission, which is going to leave Vesta later this year and fly to Ceres, it'll take a couple years to get there, is that Ceres may in fact be quite rich in ices. And in fact, some of the comets, everyone thinks of comets as coming from the icy outer solar system, there may be a reservoir of comets in the asteroid belt itself. There's a dynamical family that seemed to originate there. So the asteroid belt is actually a source of a lot of rich organics and volatiles, things like ices. Volatiles are things that either melt or flash into gas when warmed up. Unlike rock, which is, you know, once you make rock, it's pretty much rock until you raise it to thousands of degrees. So the asteroids are going to be very interesting to us because they're also leftover debris from the formation of the solar system, but they were probably important for bringing things with comets, for bringing volatiles and certain minerals to the Earth during the course of its formation. A lot of the oceans in the atmosphere were built in part by volatiles delivered by icy asteroids and comets coming in from the outer solar system during the epoch of heavy bombardment. A lot of these are made of rock and metal. They have very high densities, although some of them may be much lower density. They range in sizes from about 100 kilometers, which is underneath the size we now know of for real sterilizing impactors, to things that are a few meters across, you know, about the size of this table here. So we know that there are many millions of these things. Here's a couple of them. They have names associated with numbers. The number is the order of discovery. Named asteroids are up in the tens of thousands now. Most of the asteroids we know of live in the main belt. It's a region between the orbit of Mars and Jupiter. And there's a lot of shaping of these orbits by the gravity of Jupiter. For example, there's this big group of asteroids called the Trojans and the Greeks, which lead and trail around Jupiter. They actually follow Jupiter around its orbit. They're pushed into these places by the gravity of interaction between the gravity of Jupiter and the Sun. So they orbit the Sun, but their orbits are sculpted by the gravity of Jupiter. You can see these sort of orangish dots here that form a triangle. They're labeled the Hildas. They form another of these dynamical groups, but they're now, instead of being pushed into two, they're pushed into a 3-to-2 resonance and produce this nifty little triangle shape. And they all kind of roll around in these funny shapes. This is, again, evidence of this idea that there's sculpting of the solar system by the gravity of Jupiter. Now, small pieces of these asteroids, bits of rock, run through the entire solar system. They're kicked off of asteroids that have collisions with each other. There may be some leftover small bits. And these often fall to the Earth, where they become meteors burning up in the atmosphere. If they survive to the surface as something you can pick up, they're called a meteorite. Oh, I don't have it on that keychain. I used to carry a piece of meteoritic iron with me in my pocket. These things are all about 4.5 billion years old, and they fall into three basic classes. The stony meteors, which are basically silicates. The iron meteorites, which are mostly iron. These are like rock densities. These are big and heavy. We got a big one of these in our department, which we're bringing in one of these days. And finally, the ones that really interest us on the Earth are these so-called chondrites, because they have a very high carbon content and, as we've seen last week, some very high organics content. The Murchison meteor was one of these chondrites. These carbon-bearing chondrites actually had amino acids in it, formed in the outer solar system. So these are important to us because these are ways to deliver carbon to the Earth and deliver some complex organics. And they've still done that job, and they would have done that job for other planets in our solar system as well. So even though they may not be the sources of life themselves or sites of life, they were, in some sense, carrying some of the raw materials that life was built up of out of the Earth. And finally, there are the comets. These are very low-density composites. They're mostly ices with a bunch of rock. They're kind of dirty snowballs. Every now and then, they plunge into the inner solar system, where the sunlight begins to melt the gases off of them, and they develop these big, beautiful tails. We haven't had a really good, bright, northern hemisphere naked-eye comet since Hale-Bopp a few years ago. The last two, the great comet of 2010 was Comet McNaught. I'm sorry?
McNaught.
2006? Okay, I'm losing track now. Thank you. M.A. Comet McNaught was the first great comet of the 21st century. It was only visible from the southern hemisphere. Tells you how long it's been since I taught this class last. This is Comet Halley viewed up close, showing you there's kind of these dark, dank, dirty snowballs. They probably come from the Kuiper Belt in the space beyond Neptune and all the way out into the outer Oort cloud, a very large reservoir of icy bodies in the outer depths of the solar system. These things are occasional visitors to our inner solar system. Occasionally they've hit the Earth. Perhaps the Tunguska event may have been a small comet, according to some estimates, but it wasn't visible as a comet because it was too small. But these are important because these are what probably delivered a lot of the water ices and the gases that made up our ocean and atmospheres along with the asteroids. So they're part of the raw materials of the solar system. These are often good things to see if you can see these debris clouds around other stars, maybe a signpost that those stars have formed a planetary system, because you can see in aggregate, if not individually, the properties of that debris. And it gives us another place to know. It's a signpost that says, look here, there may be planets. So this is the tour of our solar system. Very broad brushstrokes. With the remaining lectures of this series, we're going to go into detail on these planets and start asking, could they be abodes for life? And if so, what should we be looking for? I'll see you all tomorrow.